SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water. Yiridimarang, hello, I'm your host Luana Grant and welcome to NITV Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of December. Coming up on today's show, we share a story by SBS News as the mass shooting at one of Australia's most famous beaches targeting revelers at a Jewish holiday celebration has generated shock and grief around the world. Condolences have continued to pour in and vigils have been held. And we catch up with Kamala Tharayaraja, the creative producer of the Churambada project, as part of the Perth Festival next year. But coming up first is the latest news for this Wednesday, the 17th of December. You're listening to NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, the government and opposition work on plans to combat anti-Semitism following the Bondi terror attack. Zelensky says a deal to end nearly 4 years of fighting in Ukraine could be finalised within days. And in cricket, extra security expected at the third Ashes test in Adelaide. Tributes continue for victims of the Bondi massacre as their funerals begin. The death toll includes 15 civilians and one of the two gunmen. 10-year-old Matilda, the youngest victim, was attending the Hanukkah gathering with her family when she was killed. In a statement, her school said Matilda would be remembered with love, grief and deep sorrow. At a gathering last night, her parents mourned, with her father saying they chose her name to reflect their new life in Australia after migrating from Ukraine.
Matilda was my first born in Australia, and I thought that Matilda is the most Australian name that could ever exist.
Jewish groups are urging the Prime Minister not to forget about anti-Semitism as he embarks on major reforms to Australia's decades-old gun laws. State and territory governments are considering clamping down on gun licences and banning non-citizens from owning firearms in response to the Bondi Beach attack. Executive Council of Australian Jewry President Daniel Aon says political leaders shouldn't forget the cultural changes needed to tackle hatred against Jews. The federal government says it is preparing a detailed plan to tackle anti-Semitism. Liberal frontbencher and a member of the Jewish community, Julian Lisa, has told the ABC there must be swift action from the government on anti-Semitism, and the coalition is doing its part by forming an anti-Semitism task force.
This task force is really about looking at three things. Firstly, ensuring that we're continually engaging with the Jewish community to make sure that we are representing their views properly and to put pressure on the government to implement the recommendations of the Siegel Report in full. And thirdly, to deal with issues around counter-terrorism and the joining up of our agencies at the state and federal level.
Meanwhile, the federal opposition has put its contentious migration policy on hold following the Bondi Beach mass shooting on Sunday. Opposition leader Susan Lee was expected to announce the coalition's new policy on migration this week based on assertions that migration levels in Australia are too high. Ms. Lee says she has put that announcement on hold amid concerns about fraying social cohesion and the potential for a debate on immigration to be inflammatory at an extremely sensitive time. The Australian Syrian Alliance has condemned the mass shooting at Bondi Beach, expressing solidarity with the Jewish community. A statement from the alliance condemns all forms of hatred and violence, saying anti-Semitism and Islamophobia have no place in Australia. The group also praised Ahmed Al-Ahmed, the Syrian-Australian, who risked his life to disarm one of the alleged gunmen. The alliance says his actions represent the best of Australia, adding that Syrian Australians of all backgrounds are proud to contribute to the shared safety of Australia. Former Prime Minister John Howard said Mr. Ahmed was inspiring.
The standout in that department was that magnificent man who disarmed one of the evildoers. He deserves the praise that he's received all around the world. And, of course, he himself identified as a Muslim. That is a reminder that this is not about sectarian division. This is about pure hatred.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers is to reveal a $5.4 billion improvement in the federal budget this financial year, even as the deficit sinks to its worst level in 5 years. Dr. Chalmers is expected to highlight the government's economic management as he reveals the mid-year budget update today. In last year's mid-year update, the total impact of policy decisions over Ford estimates amounted to a $17.5 billion deterioration in the bottom line. Dr. Chalmers says the budget deficit for the current financial year at $36.8 billion is projected to be $5.4 billion better than the pre-election fiscal outlook. The acting chair of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service, Narita Waite, says systematic change is needed to reduce the number of Aboriginal deaths in custody. After Australia recorded its highest number of deaths in custody last year, she's calling for action to address racist policing, a lack of access to healthcare, and overcrowding in prisons. Ms. Waite says overcrowding often leads to lockdowns, which contribute to social isolation and harm prisoners' mental health. She also criticised a move to toughen state bail laws, saying they increase the number of people being held on remand.
An alarming part of the report is that 42% of Aboriginals in custody in 2024-2025 were people who are yet to be sentenced, and that's a direct result of the punitive bail systems, which obviously have disproportionately affected Aboriginal and Torres Islander people.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and 34 other countries have formally approved plans to create a compensation body to pay for damages to Ukraine caused by the Russian invasion. The Council of Europe has facilitated the International Claims Commission, which will allow Ukrainians to seek compensation for damage, loss or injury caused by Russia since the full-scale invasion began in February 2022. The Council of Europe says Russia must foot the bill, but there is no clear pathway for forcing Russia to pay. The EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Kaja Kallas, says there have been precedents.
After Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, the United Nations Compensation Commission was able to use Iraqi oil revenues to pay reparations because a percentage of the oil sales went directly into the UN Compensation Fund. Russia is no less liable for the damage in Ukraine than Iraq was for the damage in Kuwait. But Russia will never voluntarily pay for the damage it has done.
One proposal is to use some of the tens of billions of dollars in frozen Russian assets held in Europe. Some 80,000 claims have already been filed with the Register of Damages, which is based in The Hague. United States President Donald Trump says he will soon file a lawsuit against the BBC over a report on his comments in the lead-up to the January 6, 2021 attack on the US Capitol. The BBC says it will defend its edit of his January 6, 2021 speech in a Panorama documentary. In court documents filed in Miami federal court, Mr. Trump says he is seeking $7.5 billion in damages. He foreshadowed the lawsuit's filing at an event at the Oval Office.
In a little while, you'll be seeing I'm suing the BBC for putting words in my mouth, literally, to put words in my mouth. They had me saying things that I never said coming out. I guess they used AI or something. So we'll be bringing that lawsuit. A lot of people are asking, when are you bringing that lawsuit? Even the media can't believe that one. They actually put terrible words in my mouth having to do with January 6th that I didn't say.
He acknowledged the BBC's apology but says the broadcaster has made no meaningful institutional changes to prevent what he called future journalistic abuses. To sport now, and in cricket, fans attending the third Ashes test in Adelaide Oval today can expect to see security boosted after the Bondi terror incident put authorities on high alert. South Australian police will deploy additional officers with a higher level of training and equipment to respond to possible terror events. They've warned it may take a little longer than usual to clear security and said police are working with officials from Adelaide Oval. But South Australia Police Commissioner Stephen Grant says the additional security measures have been taken out of an abundance of caution.
There is no intelligence at this time that indicates that there are any increased levels of threat or security risk around the cricket or any other community event, but notwithstanding that, we apply a level of diligence to make sure that people attending can do so with that confidence that they are attending a safe and well-managed event.
And now for a look at today's weather. Perth, partly cloudy 26, Adelaide sunny 34, Melbourne sunny 32, Hobart mostly sunny 29, Canberra mostly sunny 33, Wollongong partly cloudy 26, Sydney much the same and 26, Newcastle partly cloudy 25, Brisbane 27, Cairns showers 31, and Darwin showers easing, a storm and 38. And that is NITV Radio News.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio. Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
A mass shooting at one of Australia's most famous beaches targeting revellers at a Jewish holiday celebration has generated shock and grief around the world. As condolences pour in, the Jewish diaspora and supporters have held vigils for those impacted by the tragedy and a message of defiance against hate. Hanukkah is Judaism's annual festival of light, which triumphs over darkness and evil. And as mourners gathered in Jerusalem holding vigils for the 15 people shot dead in Australia, they held that light and shared it.
From Israel, we call on Jewish people across the world to light the candle of the Jewish people as one community with one shared identity. No matter how hard they try, they will never succeed in dimming our light. Am Yisrael Chai.
That was Yehuda Seton, CEO of the Jewish Agency, sharing a message of solidarity and love to those directly impacted.
We are with you. Your pain is our pain. We pray for the full recovery of the wounded and send comfort to the families of the bereaved for their unimaginable losses.
The Knesset, Israel's parliament, was lit to honour victims as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sent a pointed message.
Because history will not forgive hesitation and weakness. It will honour action and strength. That's what Israel expects of each of your governments in the West and elsewhere.
Farhan Haq, Deputy Spokesperson for United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, voiced his condemnation.
The Secretary-General unequivocally condemns anti-Semitism in all its forms and reiterates that attacks on religious communities and peaceful celebrations strike at the core values of tolerance, coexistence, and human dignity.
Bondi Beach has become a global icon, renowned around the world as home to surfboards, sunburns, and family fun. Its golden sands reputation making the globally shared video of Sunday night's horror and chaos all the more jarring and disturbing.
Thank you.
As news broke around the world, leaders paid tribute, including French President Emmanuel Macron, Ukraine leader Volodymyr Zelensky, and British monarch King Charles. The head of state in Canada, the Palestinian Authority, and notably Iran, also shared their condolences and concern. The Australian government has accused Iran of being linked to two arson attacks on Melbourne synagogues last year. Posting on X, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Esmaili Baki said,
"We condemn the violent attack in Sydney, Australia. Terror and killing of human beings, wherever committed, is rejected and condemned."
While US President Donald Trump extended this message of support.
"And that was an anti-Semitic attack, obviously. And it, I just want to pay my respects to everybody. But to Australia and the Prime Minister, to everybody that we know so well, we get along with so well. We have a great relationship. That's a terrible situation going on over there. Think of that."
The American Friends of Lubavitch assembled on the White House lawn with a rousing cry from Rabbi Levi Shem Tov, who honored his friend who had been killed in the attack.
"Echoing in my mind were the words that were said by Rabbi Eli Schlanger, my colleague, Hashem Yimkoyn Domoy, who said in response to a wave of anti-Semitic incidents in Sydney, really, he said, we have one response. Be more Jewish. Feel more Jewish. Look more Jewish."
That call shared among the Jewish faithful in New York. Attendees of the city's Hanukkah celebration marked the first night of the 8-day holy period with a show of defiance against hate and fear.
"We absolutely have to be here because what happened was terrible. And I'm a Jew and I'm an American and I'm going to do Hanukkah for as long as I can do Hanukkah. Publicly."
Police cars and security officers flanked the event, with attendees voicing their hope that this event would be safe.
"It's a horrible, tragic situation, and it's really sad because no matter how far we've come as far as acceptance of everyone and other cultures, there's still hate and evil in the world, and that should be stopped, and it's unacceptable."
In the outpouring of grief at the news of the 15 deaths, messages of solidarity came with recriminations. Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg of the New North London Synagogue said this was a sign anti-Semitism was homing in.
"Shocked, horrified, but not surprised, because the environment has been enabling, God forbid, this kind of thing to happen."
Security was boosted at Hanukkah events across Europe, with acknowledgements for the victims of Bondi at Hanukkah events in Berlin, Paris and London, before the European Parliament observed a moment's silence on Monday. President Roberta Metsola honouring the victims and heroes of Bondi Beach.
10-year-old Matilda and 87-year-old Holocaust survivor Alex were among the victims hunted down by the gunmen as they were on the beach. Many others are still in hospital, some in critical condition. They are all in our thoughts. And I also want to recognise that we would be talking about countless more victims today if it was not for the bravery of 43-year-old shop owner Ahmed, who, unarmed, ran into the gunfire and disarmed one of the terrorists.
The bright light of bravery shining through the dark. And that story was by Camille Bianchi for SBS News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online. Conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Coming up early next year as part of the Perth Festival is the Choham Butter Project, and this event will celebrate Widjilak Yongu Songman ceremonial leader Daniel Wilfred from Arnhem Land. The show will be set in the Perth Hills and will feature culture with dancers, musicians and elders from Noongar, Budja, India and Malaysia. NITV Radio's Kerry Lee Barry spoke with Kamal Thara Araja, creative producer, to find out more.
My name is Kamal Thara Araja. I'm a creative producer with Chidambara. Chidambara is essentially an arts organization in WA that exists to bring community and the arts together into spaces of deep and meaningful creativity. And the community has been in WA, Noongar Budja, since the 70s. Chidambara is a wing of this community that is for like I said before, to do creative work and to connect culture, the arts, and people together through spaces for creativity, you know, and that's who we are in WA.
And let's talk about your new creative project. Tell us all about it. Where do we start?
Well, the Bhumija project essentially is an endeavor to continuously and recurrently connect with the ancient way of the first peoples of Australia. And us being a community of South Asian Indian heritage, we've always found a sense of a deep uncolonized connection with the people of the land. And the Bhumija project started in 2022, essentially, where we started off with a residency called Researching Gondwana, where we started, we brought people from different cultural backgrounds into a space and spent 10 days together, simply being creative and responding to each other creatively. And from there, we birthed the Bhumija project. Since then, we have arrived in this moment now where in a couple of months we almost premiere a new work, a new experience, I would rather call it, with the Perth Festival. And that's I'm incredibly thankful to have an opportunity like this to share what we do with a broader and new audience. A deep collaborator for us is Daniel Wilfred from Arnhem Land. Daniel comes from a Wagila Yolngu community, and he's such a beautiful person who comes from quite a remote place and brings a fantastic voice. He's a song man, so he sings not for entertainment but for healing. And so Daniel Wilfred comes to WA and works with Indian classical dancers of Australian who live in Australia. So that's the sort of concept with the work. Alongside that, we have artists coming from Malaysia and India as well. So it becomes a sort of pan-Indian ocean sort of linking together. So that's the Bhumija project, yeah.
What's it been like for you as a creative to work with First Nations creative Daniel Wilfred, a songman?
I would say just absolutely amazing. To come to a country, I moved to Australia 20 years ago, and to come to a country and then to discover a way to reconnect with the country that you now call home in a way that feels familiar is special for us, for me. And Daniel works in such an unhierarchical way, in such an intuitive way, which really resonates with the kind of culture and the art that we grew up with from the heritage of India. Yeah, I think it's something special waiting to happen because it's something that's it's birthed out of Australia, yet it doesn't really have the usual roots of hierarchy and ownership. It's been very intuitive working with Daniel, very special in terms of a lot more listening than directing, and a lot more, it opens up a lot more possibility. And it has, over the past few years where we've been on this project, I've kind of really learn to trust and understand that the connection across the ocean goes way deeper and way longer than we can ever imagine. So the peoples of this land, Noongarbujja, and the people of that land, India, I think have a much, much, much deeper connection than we have even we haven't even started to uncover this. So that's what's it been like for me working with Daniel. I hope it opens more and more opportunities to work with more and more elders and leaders from the people of this ancient land. And I hope it it touches the hearts and the souls of those who come to partake and participate in our sharing in February this next year.
And just earlier you described that this creative process for you is a way to connect in a way that feels familiar to you. How so?
Right. Spaces of improvisation, spaces of intuition, spaces of flow together, you know. In the Indian classical arts, while there is a deep level of rigidity and structure in the formative years and discipline, there is also a lot of space for improvisation together and space for encountering something special together on the stage. The stage in itself becomes a space for a journey, a space for possibility to occur. And Daniel recurrently reminds us to remember that, not even through his words, but just through his being, you know. And to work with someone who is so dropped down from the mind and into the heart space and into the body is very, it's hard to come by in today's world. And to be a little less outcome oriented, a little less performance and entertainment oriented. I think these little things are reminders of for us, of why we do what we do in the arts and in the creative spaces.
And why do you think it's so important to collaborate with other cultures from around the world?
I feel like we are interconnected. Human beings are interconnected, and in ways that are hard to express in words, you know, and in books and in philosophy and in academia. I feel the arts and the culture have a distinct tool to reflect upon a connection that has always been there. We just sometimes forget. We forget us, our humanity. And from there, we move into deep spaces of colonization in our minds, and we forget our connection, our similarities, and the beauty in our difference. And I feel creativity, the arts, and culture provide perhaps the most special, the best tool for us to try to do that again.
And the show, it opens in February 2026 on the 21st of February. Why do you think people should come along and see the show?
I mean, there's so many reasons. Come along to enjoy an evening in nature. Come along to experience an immersive event that occurs from the time the sun's up through sunset and into the evening. Come along for that. If you're from WA or if you're coming to WA, WA is known for the beautiful sunset, and we are the space we are exploring the Bhumija project this time is at the foothills of the Perth Hills, you know, at the Art Sanctuary. It's a fantastic space. Come along to see something that I really sincerely feel you may not have ever seen before, where cultures are in sync together and not simply some fusion or something of that sort. More to see the cultures in sync together. Come along to partake in some simple, healthy, nice food. Come along to be with your family, to remember that the arts and culture is not just for the theatres and the serious spaces. Come along to enjoy some good music, and to perhaps even move your bodies if you feel so, and to enjoy a night under the stars. So I feel like there's a few reasons to come along, and the main focus of the evening will be a performance experience that sees the many cultures across the land and across the oceans coming together in an exploration of flowing rivers and a space for healing.
Sounds really wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today, Kamal, on NITV Radio.
Thank you. Thank you, Kerry Lee.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio. Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Coming up now, NITV Radio's Yasmin Al-Wakal yarns with Alira Toby. Alira has represented Australia in Portuguese football and also played for Sydney FC and Canberra United. She is now an ambassador for the John Moriarty Football, which engages young First Nations people through sport. As SBS is set to broadcast the new Australian Championship competition over the next 2 years, Yasmin Al-Wakal talked all things Indigenous football with Alira.
I've read online that football has always been in your family. Can you tell me about your connection to the game?
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly that in my life. Since the day I was born, my father played, all of my siblings played, my grandparents actually opened up the first football club in Mount Morgan, which is where my parents grew up. So yeah, it's quite literally been in my family since, well, when I was born, but also well before I was born.
As a First Nations person, do you think this early entry to football is unique? Do you believe the game's enmeshed in Indigenous communities compared to other sports?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that a lot of sports actually do it a lot better than football does. But I think for, you know, people that have actually grown up with it, then I think there's no looking back. For me personally, I don't think I could ever play another sport as seriously as I ever did soccer. So I'm very grateful in that sense. But yeah, I do think that a lot of other sports in our country do it far better than what we do in soccer.
You made your A-League debut at 19 years old and your career has taken you both overseas and across the country. What have been some career highlights for you?
Well, it's a really big question. I think going to play in Portugal for a little while was a really fun experience, but I don't know. I think experiencing a Matildas camp was always, you know, something I wanted, and being in that environment was such a cool experience for me. But honestly, I think just playing, I was so lucky to be able to do it. And I think, you know, the sacrifices that my parents made and also my siblings, for me to even have that chance is so special. So I think, you know, I just think playing was great. Also winning silverware is also fantastic as well. But yeah, I don't know. I think just, you know, playing and doing my family proud and myself proud and my culture proud is probably something that I'll always take away from my career.
Mm. You mentioned that football is quite a global sport. It brings people together from all around the world. But what do you think it means to Australians?
What it means to Australians, yeah, I think they love it. I think, you know, having the Women's World Cup, you know, recently, I think that really ignited the nation and showed what great sport football actually is and what it does for people. And, you know, people always talk about women's sport in general is not great and, you know, all the normal stuff. But I think, you know, being able to showcase women's sport, but also football in general at the highest level in the country really showed how much we do love it, and I think that's so cool.
Cathy Freeman was an idol for you growing up, but do you think that elite level representation in sport has grown and evolved over the past 25 years?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's grown a lot. I know when I was growing up and realised that I wanted to play professionally, there wasn't really anyone on TV that looked like me. Obviously, Cathy Freeman Icon was a role model for me, but I think just more generally, there wasn't anyone that looked like me. So I think that the access that we have now, and obviously who we see on television, has grown so much, especially on the field, off the field. It really has taken a turn, and I think we're so lucky that, you know, we can watch television or sports and 9 out of 10 times we'll see someone that looks like us doing what kids probably don't think they could do. But representation is everything, and I think the more that that happens and the more exposure there is, the better that'll be for everyone.
You are now the John Moriarty Football Scholarships Coordinator and a Program Ambassador. What's that been like?
Yeah, it's been really cool. I know that I got into working for the foundation through Jada Wyman when we were teammates at Sydney. I'm always so grateful that that was something that she, you know, brought into my life. And I recently just did a trip to Cairns to spend some time with our team that delivers on the ground there. And that was such a special week for me, and seeing all of the really beautiful communities and kids that we get to deal with on a daily basis is a really great reminder of the impact and the reach that we do have in all of our hubs. And yeah, it's a really special company to work for, and I'm grateful that I get to speak so highly of it and actually believe in the work that we do.
How do you find working with John Moriarty?
Yeah, I met him. He is such a sweet man. He is so sweet and special, and he is just so passionate about the foundation and obviously soccer, and he's always asking about, oh, when can we watch and all of this other sort of stuff. So yeah, he's a really special man to work for, and I think that, you know, what he's created and grown from his own experiences is nonetheless more inspiring than I think anyone that I've ever had to work for. So yeah, he is a very sweet, endearing man, and I'm grateful that I get to, you know, call him a friend and also someone I work for.
Mm. JMF is now in 19 communities across 3 different states. Why is it important to engage young people, particularly in those remote and regional communities?
Yeah, I think we talk about it a lot, but the access I think that remote communities have is far less than what we see here in our time here. So I think it's so important. And with our recent Deloitte's report that's been released, I think it was indicated that 95% of the educators indicate that the students actually attend the schools 1 to 2 more days than they usually would before we were in that school. So I think that that's incredible. We show ways to get kids to school but also keep them there, and that's obviously a really big problem, not problem, but it's a big hurdle, I think, in remote communities, that, you know, getting kids to school and keeping them there and keeping them off the street. So I think having our programs there is so important, because we do provide those impacts and those pathways for kids to be able to attend school and to stay there.
You've mentioned there that the foundation is about more than just football. So what kind of support does the program provide to do things like keep young people engaged in school?
We closing the gap targets, we actually do make a genuine difference there. I think that 74% of our staff are actually local Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander members from the community. We also have 46% of our coaching staff are female, and 60% of our program participants are female. So I think just without the school side of it, we are making genuine impact across many of those closing the gap targets, which is a problem in our community. So I think the fact that we have that pathway into communities and we are closing the gaps quite literally, I think that speaks more important than just what we do on the field for football. We also have 46% of our coaching staff are female, and 60% of our program participants are female. So I think just without the school side of it, we are making genuine impact across many of those closing the gap targets, which is a problem in our community. So I think the fact that we have that pathway into communities and we are closing the gaps quite literally, I think that speaks more important than just what we do on the field for football.
JMF is just one company. Do you believe more generally needs to be done to improve pathways for Indigenous footballers?
Yeah, I think always. I think pathways can always be improved. I think opportunities can always be better. And it is all about having conversations and having the awareness that, you know, programs like ours do actually have an impact and create long-lasting change within communities and lives in the spaces that we work. So, yeah, I think it's very important.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
And that's all we have time for on today's program. You can catch up on any of our stories on our website at sbs.com.au or listen online through the SBS audio app. NITV Radio will be back on Friday with more stories from right across the country. I'm your host, Sawana Grant, Mundungur. Thanks so much for joining me and have a great day.